Hello, I'm Louise Herity and welcome to Playback Daily for Wednesday, the 12th of February. Here's some of what's coming up over the next hour.
I got diagnosed at 14. I would say okay. I went on to do nursing and then I went on to become an occupational therapist, and I did not embrace it until I was in doing occupational therapy.
Like, that is just such a, that's a key skill in the guards, chatting but also listening. Because that's what we're doing every single day. We're out there.
Very good.
Yeah, I missed seeing Back to the Future 1 in the cinema. I definitely went to Back to the Future 2 for a birthday, but it would have been VHS down Extravision and convincing my folks to
allow you watch.
To watch Marty McFly tear around on the back of a Jeep.
Well, we're going to start with Tuesday night's arena, and from photographing the skateboarders on the streets of Dublin to some of Hollywood's biggest stars, photographer Rich Gilligan has a fascinating story, and he joined Sean Rocks to talk about his work and latest exhibition.
His career has taken him from underground skate culture to the streets of New York to intimate portraits of figures like Cillian Murphy, Saoirse Ronan and Barry Keoghan. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by Rich Gilligan. Back to the Future. That's where it all started, Rich, I believe.
That's where it all kicked off. Yeah. Well, that was where I guess my fascination with skateboarding kicked off, which then in time and over time led to an interest in photography.
Yeah. When did that? Because, I mean, you were growing up in Coolmine in and around, what, the 80s and 90s, was it?
Yeah, I missed seeing Back to the Future 1 in the cinema. I definitely went to Back to the Future 2 for a birthday. But it would have been VHS down Extravision and convincing my folks to
allow you watch.
To watch Marty McFly tear around on the back of a Jeep.
And were you much of a skateboarder yourself in and around the streets of the estate where you were living?
Yeah, probably the only one at that time. But
do you still skateboard?
I do indeed. Yeah, I built a ramp this year that I have in my garden in Wicklow. So I'm not as nimble as I was, but definitely still rolling.
Well, there you go. Some people stop at a certain point in time, but you're keeping it going. That is obviously the interest in skateboarding, totally understandable for a young fellow growing up in suburban Dublin in the 80s and 90s. Back to the Future being a big part of that for lots of people at that time, let's face it. But when then did photography start to become a thing and skateboarding one of the major themes? Certainly in the early work, I think it was very important, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was kind of the only subject matter I was interested in. So when I suppose when I first picked up a camera or had the inkling to try and create images, I had no real interest in photography. I was interested in skateboard photography. So for me, at that time in a pre-internet age, it was magazines. And that was how I kind of discovered the culture. So it was really looking at photographs in magazines like Thrasher from San Francisco and RAD from the UK. I would look at these images and just be fascinated about the clothes people wore and the graphics that was on people's boards. And I guess because I realized I was never going to turn pro, I also was like, here's a way I can like explore this subculture and maybe like get myself in the room somehow.
Yeah. And what's interesting about, I suppose, skateboarding as, because these are still photographs, in inverted commas, still photographs. But I'm going to tweet one, a picture from 2002, which I think is part of the exhibition, the first draft being the name of the exhibition. This is Paul Tremor, 2002, at RTE Arena, if you want to see this this image of Rich Gilligan's. You saw the images from LA, you saw the images from different cities in England, but you wanted to give, here's the Irish version of that. And this, anybody looking at the image now, it's, I presume it's a public toilet or it's a bath of some kind.
It's a public bathroom right on the seafront in Tremor.
In Tremor in County Waterford. And there's a guy, Paul, I presume.
Yeah, Paul McKean is his name.
Yeah, well, and still about, and you're still
aware? Still skating. Paul lives in Madrid. He's a dub, another Northsider, but Paul... Still, we've reconnected in doing the show. We ended up sending them the picture, and
And it's a roof that has various, you know, diagonals and slants on it, which is perfect for skateboarding. Down one, up the other, and
it's
jump
actually
across.
Yeah, it's something that we had like been eyeing it up for years. There was a gang of like younger surfers and skaters because my dad's from Tremor, I would spend summers with my cousins there, and we would just look at this thing and be like, oh, someone could hit this, and then Paul was like he was a skater from Dublin, but he was sponsored and he was one of the best in the country at that time. And I'd started doing work for this English magazine, Sidewalk. So when we went there, it wasn't planned. Paul kind of like scaled up and like just started skating. And I think I shot like 10 frames and thankfully one of them worked. Mm. But
yeah, because this is a pre-internet age, it's pre-digital age.
Everything's analog.
Yeah, you were doing everything on film, black and white film as well at the time.
Processing all my film by hand and spending hours and hours in dark rooms, getting covered in probably really bad chemicals, but loved it.
And particularly with an image like the one we're looking at there, which gives us that, like, you really need to capture a moment in action. If he's too low on the board, there's no movement in it.
Yeah.
If he was flat on the roof, there's no movement in it. Is there an element of luck, or is there, does skill come into it and craft come into it as well?
Yeah, I mean, it is. There's craft in that, like, I mean, if you want to talk about like Henri Cartier-Bresson and the idea of the decisive moment, timing is really important, obviously. And it's one thousandth of a second is what you need to be shooting at your shutter to freeze movement like that.
Wow.
So you're kind of like poised and ready to go, but you tune into it. And I guess, you know, in time you kind of get better at it. But I mean, don't get me wrong, I messed up like roll after roll of film, but thankfully it worked out this day.
And this is a question I've asked of many photographers. Is it essential actually to just be looking through the viewfinder? There's no point in having the camera down here saying, oh, there's a great shot, because by the time you get the camera up, it's gone.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because even now, though I shoot digitally, I still like to look through glass, and I still like the physicality of actually, you know, creating what exists within a frame and really thinking about just, you know, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of the kind of publications and iconic skate images I would have looked at, they were like blue skies in California the mean streets of New York. But I was like, cool, this really looks like Ireland, and it's kind of grim, but also kind of beautiful in this like brutalist kind of architecture that was, they're actually gone. The toilets have been bulldozed.
It's a real shame because they...
but in a kind of full circle moment, they've built a really amazing concrete skate park literally on the same spot 25 years later. So
I want to take another picture from the exhibitionist before we get on to your move to New York and all of that, because Blanchardstown was obviously hugely formative and Coolmine in those early years for you. I want to tweet a picture now called Fire Kids. This is a colour picture from a little bit later, to 2004. I thought it was going to be later than that. But what amazes me here is essentially three guys, it's a colour photograph this time, three guys sitting looking at a fire and another kid off and slightly in the distance, slightly off, out of focus. But somehow in this, despite the stillness, there's a sense of movement in there as well. Movement is clearly hugely important to you.
Yeah, I guess it's that idea of using images as ways to tell stories. I'm interested in storytelling. So this would have been made, this was my first ever medium format camera. So essentially it's film, it's a Hasselblad camera that I'd gotten, but it was really like a way for me to work with this. Like I could kind of dip into this subculture and create these moments where I could have like a sense of drama, I suppose, is what I'm getting at. Or like the idea of creating something that felt cinematic in terms of like maybe it's slightly underexposed, so the flames draw you in, but it's actually quite dark in the foreground. But there's also this energy of people moving around, and there's a sense of like anticipation.
And you're not lighting that. You're using the natural light of the fire.
No, it's just all
whatever you capture that.
That's
moment
actually then. Probably the movement. It's like there's like slight bit of like camera shake or something. But for me, I'm
nervous
like,
that you're going to get something.
Yeah,
or not.
I'm never. I don't mind things technically not being perfect.
Yeah, it's more about if it has the right right feel of it. So, and this exhibition in Drake kind of, I think to a large extent, looks back on those early pictures and looks back on that period in time. However, the move came to New York was 2015.
Yeah, yeah.
Avalanched that into being?
Yeah, kind of sheer determination, if I'm honest, because we had just, my daughter Robin, shout out to Robin, she was one at the time, she'd just been born. So everyone kind of was like, "What? You can't move to New York with a 1-year-old." And but we ended up we sorted out all the visa stuff, which is a nightmare. But the reason we went was I'd started to get a lot of work over there.
And what was the nature of that work? You know,
that would have been more commissioned work. So I guess a mix of lots of editorial portraiture with different artists and musicians and actors, and then also commercial work. So I would work for lots of brands and kind of like design agencies and music labels. So it just was really a place that, beyond like professional development or whatever you want to call it, I've always been completely fascinated with New York City. And it's somewhere where, you know, a lot of the things, my core kind of like formative years of my interest in hip hop and like punk music and then skate culture, it's kind of like the epicenter of a lot of that stuff. And also photographically, you know, early work of like the likes of Nan Golden and Robert Frank. There's lots of artists whose work was maybe not even necessarily created there, but they were from there.
Yeah.
So it drew me.
You felt
in.
You were going to the center of something, or to an important place for this, for your particular art form. But I'm looking then, so 2015 was the time there, and here we are now, what, 10 years later?
Yeah, it's actually this month. I was just thinking about it today. So we left on the 28th of Feb, 2015.
So. Oh, wow. So you really are approaching that 10th anniversary. Do you divide the time equally between, you're saying Wicklow now is where you have the ramp out the back, presume that's where you're living. So is the time divided between Ireland and the US now, or how is it?
Pretty much full time in Ireland. Mm. We moved back 4 years ago, and I still have, like, I'd still have an agent who represent me for commercial projects in the States. So I would generally go back once a year or whenever.
Do a bit of work or whatever.
So
when
stuff comes up, I bounce back and forth. But actually, it's been really busy here. And with everything working out with this exhibition, this has been like probably about 4 years of like slowly working on this, where when the commission came through Fingal, through the arts office there, getting this award. So the ARC Fingal, like that award that I got.
And how important was it, the getting of that? Like, essentially a local award for you.
Yeah, it was huge. Like, in terms of, well, I guess what I'm trying to get at is, up until I got this award, it was very hard for me to allocate time to really concentrate on personal work.
Right.
And in terms of doing this exhibition.
And is it just the financial freedom to do it?
100%. Yeah, absolutely. So for me, I'm not like one of these people where I look down on my like commissioned work or my commercial work. For me, it all kind of feeds into the same practice. But equally, I know what it's like when it's kind of famine or a feast, where I can get so busy with commissions that ultimately personal work will take a back burner, despite your best intentions.
I'm looking at District Magazine here, where you're talking a lot about, you know, you're talking about your time going up to Easton on O'Connell Street, seeing that first copy of Thrasher. It's an article that kind of brings us through your journey through the photographic world. Some amazing portraiture in this. I'm looking at one right now, Barry Keoghan, one where he's kind of leaning back against a rock and laughing. Another where he's slightly off camera. Further down that page, Saoirse Ronan directly down the lens, looking at us. And there's one further down, I think, of Timothy Chalamet. Kind of off into the distance. I'm not doing them justice in describing this. But what I found interesting, and I know you've photographed Cillian Murphy as well, when it comes to portraiture, you're still looking for that magic moment, I guess.
Totally.
What is the difference between that and the kind of the action photograph of the skateboard? How do you approach that as a photographer differently?
Yeah, I mean, in all honesty, I think part of my approach is that there is no difference. So whether I'm photographing someone on a roof they shouldn't be
on.
doing like skating, or, you know, it's this idea that, I guess it's like the energy you bring to someone when you create a portrait with them, it's kind of reflected back on you. So a lot of it would be just learning how to kind of like read the room and knowing like how to push and pull in terms of like, is this person really tired? Have we only got 5 minutes to create, you know, a cover shot and a double spread or whatever? So a lot of it's really just trying to, it's people skills and it's experience. but it's also curiosity. So I'm like, I'm nosy and I'm very...
Do you talk during these sessions?
Yeah, sometimes it's a bit of an issue because like the time is limited and I'll end up just yapping and then I'm like, oh, I better get this done. Like it's like that thing where I talk a lot before, but when I'm shooting, I really don't try to direct people that much because I want to try and get a portrait. Say, for example, if it's a musician or if it's an actor, it's for me, I'm trying to like always explore these in-between moments, maybe where someone lets their guard down, or sometimes it's a moment where there's a sense of intimacy where ultimately you've built a kind of level of trust where they feel like they can kind of
be themselves.
Yeah. And it's weird to describe because it sounds like some weird smoke and mirrors thing, but it's not. A lot of it's just like putting people at ease and being able to like walk into a room and connect with someone or find common ground. That's something I always...
And patience, I guess, must be part of it. Even though you might be under the, you've got 3 minutes to get this shot, Rich.
Yeah. No, like the amount of pre-production that goes into things that people would never really think about. And you might have all the plans in the world for like some elaborate lighting setup, and then you turn up and you're like, right, go by that window. You've got like 2 minutes. We'll make it work. So that again, that's when experience kicks in. So. Yeah.
Well, congratulations on the award and the achievements to date, Rich, and delighted that it's given you the time to free up a little bit of space for the personal work, which must be hugely satisfying. And I presume the 11-year-old now, Robin, will be out in Blanchardstown with you for the opening.
She's going to be there with her sister, Simone.
So, there we go. Shout out to both of them. You better keep yourself on side.
I know.
Thanks to Rich Gilligan. Not at all. That's Rich Gilligan. The First Draft is the title of the exhibition. It's at the Ground Floor Gallery in Drake from tomorrow. Wednesday, is it tomorrow Wednesday 19th of February or tomorrow week?
It opens tomorrow week, Wednesday
the 19th of February, and it will be there through until Saturday the 3rd of May. Full information on dreacht.ie.
Rich Gilligan on Tuesday Night's Arena with Sean Rocks. Oliver Callum was talking about the latest Garda recruitment campaign. It's underway now. And to hear all about life on the beat, he was joined by recent Garda recruits, Manus Murphy, based in Store Street in Dublin, and Fionnuala McCorry, who's based in Navan.
So congratulations to the two of you. When did you come out of Temple Moor, Manus?
We tested on the 15th of December in 2023 now, just following the events of the November riots. So we were pushed forward about 2 weeks, I think.
That's it.
If you remember. And then we returned to Temple Moor to finish some key modules after Christmas. But very much.
This was to get the presence up in Dublin City after those riots at the end of 2023. And so it was like an amnesty of sorts, wasn't it, to get recruits out on the street?
It all happened very quickly now. We were sent out 2 weeks before Christmas just to help with the situation. And then we were brought back in January for 2 weeks. And then we had the family down for the attestation, which was great.
That's the graduate attestations. What do they call it?
Attestation.
That's the official term. Yeah, attestation. It's very formal altogether. But it's a great day out for the family. Like, people are obviously so proud of us.
Whatever that word means, it's just a good day out is what happens.
Dead right.
Manus, tell us a little bit about yourself. You're from Dublin.
I am from Ballyfermot originally. And I have a background in retail. Went to college out of school and lived abroad in Australia for a bit as well. And thankfully, coming into the Garda role, I had a bit of life experience behind me, which I do think is a positive for anyone out there thinking of applying.
Yeah, because some will go straight in, won't they, from...
Some do. And look, what I will say is that like no strength is too small in the guards. Like anything you have, whether it's good communication skills or good technology skills, that there'll be a home for that in the job, regardless of what you bring.
And you literally worked in retail. What sort of retail was it?
Retail. So I worked in men's fashion in retail and a couple of different jobs, to be honest. I worked in business abroad as well in the co-working industry. So that was a bit kind of higher numbers, higher volume. But yeah, like it was just overall, as I don't know if you can tell, I love chatting. I love talking to people. I'm sure Fionnuala will tell you all about that. But it like that is just such a key skill in the guards, chatting, but also listening. because that's what we're doing every single day when we're out there.
Very good. Very good to hear. So the retail thing would have really helped you because you were...
Really? Any role dealing with the public. I also worked in hospitality throughout the duration of being in college. So
how old are you? you seem like you're barely out of college.
Oh, no, it's the SPF. I keep the skincare going well. no, look, like any of those skills you have, it's going to be great. And just dealing with the public, like I'm married to a nurse. You know, there's a lot of crossover there. I know the nurse guard combo thing is a bit...
We would never stereotype.
I know, not at all.
But come here, where did you go to college? You went to Tel IT?
I did, for European studies right out of school. That's 2011 now, 2012.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that was before I worked for a bit in retail. Then I went abroad. And being abroad, I actually got to know a lot of police officers in Australia.
Okay.
I'm into martial arts myself. That's kind of my pastime, my hobby. And shock horror, lots of police officers.
You're clearly one of these people who don't sleep. Martial arts inside.
Yeah, coming off at night is tough. But, you know, I met a lot of police officers over there who would have kind of convinced me to think more seriously about the job. And should I say, actually, when I was in retail, like a recurring customer of mine was the first guard I actually got to know. I don't come from a Garda family. I don't have a large, long history of guards in either side of my family. But he was the first guard I met who started to kind of plant the seed in my mind, you know, oh, you're a good communicator. Have you thought about this, that, you know? So, yeah, that's where it started for me.
Great. Okay, we get, and Fionnuala, and this is the great thing about the guards, isn't it? You can come from everywhere the country.
That's exactly.
So tell us about yourself.
I'm from Belfast originally, and I'm 30 years old. Before I joined the guards, I was teaching for 5 years in a grammar school in the north. And I went travelling then for 2 years. I went to Dubai and I worked in Dubai for a year. And
what did you do there, teaching as well?
I worked as an au pair for for a family actually from Mayo. They wanted someone to look after their child who had Irish and bring the child up speaking Irish. So I worked alongside them. And
wow, you were a gold. It was an Irish speaking au pair in Dubai and you arrive at the scene.
Yeah,
that was a fascinating year.
Yeah, it was great. And then I came back from Dubai and I went to Vancouver in Canada.
Beautiful.
And that's where I actually applied for the guards when I was over there. I saw it online and...
Because as a teacher, you would have gone through a lot of education to become a teacher and then 5 years.
Yeah, I did a degree in Irish language and literature in University of Ulster, McGee. And that was a 3-year course. And I went on then to do a postgraduate certificate in modern languages. And that qualified me to be a secondary school teacher. So I did that for 5 years. And I suppose every day was just becoming kind of very ritual and boring for me towards the end of the 5 years. And I felt like a lot of my friends were kind of going away, travelling, and that's something that I really wanted to do. So I just took a brave step and stepped away from the teaching. And it wasn't my plan. My plan was to go back teaching. Mm-hmm. But being away, travelling and gaining life experience and meeting new people, I suppose just give me the courage to try something new in life.
You were sitting looking at a lovely sunset.
Yeah.
Wondering about your life. Yeah. As we do in our 20s.
Oh no, it was the best decision I've ever made.
It's interesting, both of you were travelling at the time. You were kind of thinking about going into the car.
Yeah. I actually did my interview over in Canada online on Zoom. It was 5 a.m. where I was and it was 2 p.m. here. Yeah. So
I'm sure you used to being up at that time.
Yeah, I was exhausted doing the interview, but I got it in the end. So. Yeah.
And you did it through Atsquelga, did you?
Yes, I went through the Irish stream, Oliver, when I applied. You had when you said in your application, you have a choice to go through the Irish stream. And I chose to do that because I wanted to do the interview in Irish. And as well as that, when you do tick that box on the application, you're agreeing that you may be put into a Gaeltacht area. And I'm based in Navan now. And within the division, there are two Gaeltacht areas, one being Rakharn and the second one being Ballygib. So the Irish language is utilised a lot.
And so all of your training was Atsquelga as well throughout the...
No, like I would have done the interview through Irish we study Irish in the college anyway. So
Fionnuala was a massive resource to our class. We're very, very able to help everyone, especially people who are coming from abroad. You know, people who have no Irish, that's the first interaction they've had with the Irish language is their training in Templemore. So having someone like Fionnuala was just a gold dust.
Sure, we all have our own skills, you know. Manus here was great at the red man and the
the
self defence.
Red man is what we'd call.
I have seen this video online. Explain it now to the uninitiated.
So red man is what we refer to when we're talking about the red man suit. It is the defensive suit the instructors wear when we're going through various self defence modules and I suppose pseudo martial art training, which is more focused around police work, like, you know, utilising the various PPE we have, like batons, pepper sprays, handcuffs, and then more simple things like spatial awareness. There's a few modules which are quite tough, like there's one you do in kind of a padded house where you're going into a domestic scenario, so you don't know the layout of the house, which is very, you know, true to real life. And the layout of the house changes between each student sometimes, so you're going in and sometimes it's one instructor in a red man suit and then two people in normal clothing, and you don't know who the suspect might be, who the person who's going to, you know, jump on top of you is. You just don't know. And you have to deal with that kind of, like, take control and deal with real life scenario. So I think I was able to help the class with that a little bit.
God, the adrenaline. Must be something else.
Oh, it's great.
Are there kind of rows over who ends up in the red suit?
The instructors are in the red suit, which is even better because you get to take your anger out on them.
Take a hammering.
So you've been in a classroom all day doing lectures with them, and then in the evening sometimes, you know, they're in a big padded suit running at you with a baton. So, I mean, you get to take your...
People can enjoy it on the Garda Instagram account.
They sure can.
It's very hypnotic. You can lose a lot of time watching those videos. So, Manus, you're in Australia and you're doing your martial arts and you're chatting to police officers. That's your kind of are these your initial thoughts?
No, so mine go like a way back. Like that customer I had, I know it seems so small, but when I was like 22, 21, coming out of college, working in retail, maybe I was 23, he was the person that really pushed me, and I kept contact with him throughout the years. But he'd also advised me as well that, you know, it wouldn't be the worst thing to go abroad first and gain more life experience. And that's something I would also say to anyone who's bringing experience on board. It's something they could think of. But I was really kind of rekindled in my interest when I met those Australian police officers, because, you know, the world around the job is very similar, although there are different, obviously, factors that play a part. And I just realised that it was a very like-minded type of people I was talking to.
Right.
You know, a lot of them are into martial arts, a lot of them are into their fitness. Especially the way they would talk. They're very particular people, and I kind of enjoy that element of in myself. So that's what rekindled my decision.
Do they speak differently? Do the police forces?
Yeah, we have our secret sign language.
We never noticed.
But really, like, convinced me to, like, I think I'll go back to what Fionnuala said, like, gave me the courage to apply. And I think, just a quick note on that for anyone who is thinking about it, if you are thinking of applying, talk to a guard. We're not very hard to find. Do you know, like, where is your local Garda station? Google it, go there, ring the local Garda station, see if you can make an appointment. Like, we are absolutely more than willing to talk to people. I do it all the time on the beat, on O'Connell Street.
We've learned this morning that you Gardaí love to be a kind chatting all the time.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Fionnuala, you're based in Avon, but you cover the Gaeltacht region in Cundé an Mhí.
Yeah.
So is it busy? What do you specifically hover in a certain area?
It wouldn't be Navan as such. It would be Kells Garda Station, who would cover a lot of Rakarn and Ballygib.
Yeah.
But if they're, I suppose, low on numbers, we would assist. And as part of, when you're on probation, you have to propose community projects to engage with the community. One of my proposals when I started was to engage with Irish speakers in Rakarn and Gibbstown. And the proposal was basically to set up bilingual checkpoints. And that introducing myself as a newly qualified guard in the area was a great way to get to know everyone. And I suppose offer them the chance to have a checkpoint through Irish, which the feedback from that was outstanding.
Very good. Just having it simply
just having a simple, even if it was just having a chat, they really, really respected the chance, I suppose, to have a conversation in Irish.
People were never so delighted to be at a checkpoint.
Yeah.
There's a couple of fuckle. Yeah. Is it quiet in your patch at the moment? Is that a very busy?
Navan would be busy. Yeah. You know, it's obviously not on a par with Manus here in Store Street, but we are
a different type of busy, I'd say.
Yeah,
in the city centre. What is the different type of busy?
They would have a lot of members on beat. We would have a mixture. We'd have, say, two cars out and two members on beat, one in the station, possibly one in the Custy area and one doing paperwork, where you would probably have about 30 people.
Yeah, when I first attested and got placed in Store Street, we had, I think, about 20 or more to a unit, with two sergeants to manage it at a time, and that filters up through our inspectors and so on. About 8 months on what we would call the regular, which is the core unit that cover the core duties of any Garda station, I progressed into a non-core unit, which is called Operation Citizen. So Operation Citizen's remit is to be high visibility policing in high volume areas. So I do be patrol every single day of the week, which is my favourite type of policing for me. I like to be out in the public eye. I like to talk to people. It's a great way to gather intelligence on your local area, to get to know places. Like, the funniest thing about being newly qualified is, depending where you go, it's going to be so different. If your district has an airport in it, the legislation you're going to be dealing with is so different than if it has a hospital. Even geographically, if there's rivers, cliffs, fields, or for us, we have massive sprawling business districts, you're going to be required to do different things. So there is a bedding in phase, but I'm really, really happy to be out walking the beat, I have to say.
How long was your bedding in phase?
It's still going on, Oliver. 14 months to be accurate. But look, our probation is 2 years past the point of our attestation, and you are still studying in that time period, because there are elements of the BA in applied policing that you're finishing while you're newly appointed as a guard. So there is a lot to do.
Yeah, and this is after you're kind of, it's 3x3, isn't it? There's the 3 months, it's a nine months into the training. It's
3 months in Templemore initially, 3 months as a trainee, where you will have, if you're out there in the street and you see guards wearing these blue coloured epaulettes on their shoulders.
Light blue,
so not like the ones we're wearing here today. That identifies them to Garda members as a trainee.
Oh, right.
So someone who's not yet fully attested, but they're in their training phase and they're there like in an observational manner. So we did that for 3 months, which was excellent. That was brilliant, just to be able to see what the job was like, hands on.
And then you go back into Templemore.
Back to Templemore to finish off exams, modules.
No paperwork. You just get to sit back and watch how to be a guard.
Just have a lovely time.
Yeah, you get to see some of the more mad stuff, and then it doesn't stay with your workload after. You can go home and be like, oh, isn't this great?
Yeah.
It's like, if only there wasn't paperwork, but unfortunately there is. And time in court as well, I presume you spend a lot of time.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, we would, especially in Navan, where we are. We have a new judge now who wants us to be there on the first day, especially for traffic matters, to get things rolling and to get things over the line quicker.
Excellent judge. Good to hear.
Yeah.
sped up. It's enjoyable though, isn't it? You're here talking about how much you love this job.
I love it.
Yeah.
Absolutely love it. Like Vanilla said, like, I was getting to a kind of part in the road of my older jobs where I could see that it was narrowing in. I didn't have a brilliant way to kind of like broaden my learning. The scope in the guards is endless. Like, it is endless. Like, the foundation of knowledge you get in Templemore teaches you essentially how to get more knowledge when you get out there and pick a field. And those first 2 years like are super foundational for anyone. Like the fact that everyone has to do the base job, everyone has to walk the beat, everyone has to go in the car, everyone has to be in the station, like, that teaches you, like, you cut your teeth on that, for lack of a better word. And you'll identify very soon what you like, whether it's drugs or traffic or what have you.
Garda Fionnuala Macquarie and Garda Manus Murphy chatting to Oliver Callan this morning. And if you're interested in applying to an Garda Síochána, log on to publicjobs.ie. The closing date for applications for this round is the 27th of February. Airbus is reportedly revisiting the concept of a double-decker seat for passengers in economy class. The crux of this design is the removal of the overhead cabin to allow two levels of seats in a single aircraft cabin. Could it become a standard feature of flying? Well, Claire Byrne was joined by Kevin Byrne, retired Air Corps Lieutenant Colonel and Airport Security and Safety Auditor, to discuss.
Good morning, Claire.
Now, the dual level seat, the company who are designing this, who are looking at it for Airbus, they say they're at some early stage options.
Yes.
It would appear it could be one step closer, though, from becoming reality, just having a look at the pictures today. Can you explain to people how it looks and how it might work?
Yes, when I saw this probably in 2023, I was reminded once again of a movie I saw as a child called Spartacus, and later another movie called Gladiator, where they put slaves in two rows in their galleys and they were able to row along in the water like that. And that's exactly what it struck me as now, because one seat level is lower down and above you, in front of you, is the back of the seat in front. It's a very weird arrangement, to say the least. And it's not something we'd see anywhere else in any other form of transport, I don't think. It's certainly very weird. But I am not much in favour of it for two reasons. Well, for more than two reasons, indeed. But the first reason is the passenger mix we have now at the moment. 10% of the people flying on our airlines are probably fearful of flying. And I don't think this arrangement of the seats will help them in any way. So it looks like a claustrophobic kind of arrangement, whether you're on the top row or the bottom row. The second one is 10% of our people should be thought of as people of reduced mobility. So how do they get up? Do they get up the stairs to the top deck? Are they confined to the lower level of seats? And it's a mix and one seat above the other. It's quite unusual and it doesn't work anywhere else in transport, to my knowledge.
Well, when I was reading what the designer of this said this morning, he was saying that you'd have the dual layer sort of in the middle section of the plane, and then at either end you'd have regular seating that we're all so accustomed with, so you'd have a choice. But according to him, the advantage is if you're on the upper level, you've got great recline ability with your seat, and if you're on the lower level, you can stretch your legs out, and who doesn't want to do that?
Indeed, but it's still claustrophobic. The second point I should make, or third point indeed, is the fact that the overhead bins are remarkably lucrative for our low-cost carriers at the moment, because you have to pay something like 20-odd euros each direction whenever you're going to fly, you see. So to lose the bins even in the middle of the aircraft will be, you know, a loss for them, despite the fact that they're going to get extra seats. The second point is about low-cost carriers, and indeed many of them around the world have things called fixed seats. They're not reclinable, because it saved $60,000 per aircraft when they bought them new, and they didn't have to repair the broken ones, which was a serious impediment to low-cost carriers. So many airlines, including people who fly Airbuses, have fixed seats.
Oh,
so
and that's an economic decision. I think a lot of people might be aware of that, right?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, it's not. First of all, you squeeze more seats in, if you know what I mean. The new Boeing Max, for example, has 198 seats. It would actually take 200, but they put in 198 for reasons. And then the aircraft are not out of service when they break the seats. In the first, genre, they were had a lot of broken seats, which means you have to repair them and they cost money. So that's why they fix seats, save money.
So why do you think it is that this design option is still being examined then, if what you seem to be telling us is that the airline industry has looked at this so many times and always said no?
This reminds me of what Michael Leary said jokingly one day in a particular public forum. He said maybe people could stand up and hang out of the ceilings like they do on the Lewis or stuff like that. I think it's one of these fanciful things. There's another point I should make now. Would this cause a problem to the 25-minute turnarounds, which the low-cost carriers specify at the moment? Would it take you longer to get up the seats and down the seats and that kind of thing? And even worse than that, when you're sitting at an aircraft, you usually have a window. You mightn't be at the window seat, but there's a window left and right. Excuse me. So who gets the seats then with the windows if you've got, you know, two layers of them? The seat will be in the middle. It adds to the claustrophobia. You're going to have a very dark downstairs and probably a darkened upstairs because your head will be rubbing off the ceiling, so to speak. The
well, you're very tall, Kevin, so that might be
indeed
a problem for you.
Indeed I am. But while I like extra seat room, I don't think you're going to get it in this particular model.
Do you think you'd get more people on the plane, though, if you did this?
You might, but it would want to be very short term. It'll take something, you know, a while to sell it to the people. It would work very well, by the way, in the business class because they already have their own pods. So if you're prepared to pay maybe 4.5 times the price of the, you know, the low, the standard fare, the economy fare, as it were, you would get a lovely pod. For example, the new version of the two seats that we've just discussed has a 2 meter bed in it. I mean, who wouldn't like that for a long haul flight in that regard?
You'll pay for that.
You will pay for it and they'll squeeze more in from that point of view. So it's all about money, but I'm not sure the public is ready to take this on board. I could be wrong, but it's going to have some selling point required. You know, some marketing will have to be done beforehand.
Yeah, just listening to what you were saying about it feeling more claustrophobic. I mean, isn't that a problem in economy class, particularly on short haul, that it is very tight now? You've got three across, you know, you've got three and three across. And if the plane is full, it does feel claustrophobic. Whereas if you had three people up higher, three people down lower, and more of a gap in between, that surely would improve.
Would you have to pay more, though, because you've just said that in the front and the back of the aircraft are going to have standard one flat seating, as it were. You know what I mean? It's a strange model from that point of view. My other point is it concerns flight safety, which I bang on about from time to time. Can you escape the aircraft in the case, for example, of a crash landing through the chutes on the two layers, or would it cause more consternation in that regard? Mm-hmm. I just don't know how that works, because also you have to be able to do it in a certain time, which is, of course, tested by the regulators. Can that be done if you've got in the middle two layers of seats, one on top of the other? I just don't know.
In general, Kevin, are they always looking at the fit out of the plane when it comes to where people are sitting and how people are sitting, and what's the driver behind that if they are?
Yes, indeed. It's all to do with the economy. I mean, you have to admire Boeing for putting in the Boeing Max, which was a bit of a disaster for the first couple of years of service. But they squeezed into the same fuselage length an extra 18 seats, if you know what I mean. Now, what they didn't tell you was the seats in the front row, the front 12 rows, are less spacious, because I sat in one and I got onto the chief pilot, whom I knew well, and I said, you didn't tell me that the front row 12 seats aren't the same as the back row. He said, on average, they're 32, or whatever the figure was anyway, in inches. So you have to be careful. But you can pay extra, as I didn't do recently, but I still got over wing exit seat for free. And it was another, you know, 3 or 4 inches. It was a very comfortable place to be. And you can pay for that. And it's all about return. How much money can we make on a particular type of model of aircraft on a particular route? Mm-hmm. And if we can make money on it, it's profitable. If we won't, we'll stop serving it, or we'll change the aircraft type.
So that is always the driving force.
Yeah, I'm afraid
so. Behind research, because there are a couple of challenges. There's, you know, they're looking at the speed, and we know we abandoned the Concorde model some years
indeed.
Back. So, and we have the fuel issue as well,
trying to make
it more climate change friendly. But you're saying it really always comes back down to the money and the economics of that flight.
It has to. That's how aviation is. It's all to do with yield. How many can we make? That's why, for example, I was in many airports and people would literally grab my arm and say, please send more aircraft. And I'd say, that's not how the model works. We'd put 4 aircraft here or 3 aircraft or serve your route if it can return a profit. If there's money to be made somewhere else, they'll take the aircraft away from this airport. And that's why low-cost carriers, and indeed established carriers, they shut down routes for a while until such time as they can see that the yield will be good enough to make it justifiable. Because after all, the airlines go bankrupt all the time, unfortunately, and you can lose money just as quickly as you might make it.
Kevin, we won't see you on a double-decker plane anytime soon, I fear.
I hope not.
Kevin Byrne, retired Air Corps Lieutenant Colonel, on Today with Claire Byrne. On Liveline, Joe Duffy was discussing dyslexia after U2 star Larry Mullen recently spoke on US television about his son and the effect his dyslexia had on the family.
Now, here's Larry talking, and he explains in it, listen, I don't normally talk about my family, but I do want to talk about dyslexia.
You know, I knew my son was dyslexic, but I really didn't understand him. And it was difficult in the house, you know, like two guys in the house. I was away, coming home, he's acting out, they've got the police at the house. And, I've spent all my career avoiding talking about my family. What happened was I saw this documentary and it hit home and I kind of felt, OK, I need to deal with this. Mm-hmm. And the realising and recognising what I didn't do and what I could have done. So what can I do now?
Yeah.
How can we better understand our kids who are going through these things?
And Leo is in Tala. Leo, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
You admire that, a lot of people having... I read it and then I listened to it, and my admiration for Larry couldn't go up much more, because I'm extremely in admiration of him. But it went up. You say we need someone like that in Ireland to get rid of this stigma around dyslexia.
Well, you see, the problem with dyslexia is that it's not terminal insofar as you die from it,
yeah.
But it is terminal insofar as that you live with it for the rest of your life.
Okay. Good point, yeah.
Because like, I'm 76 now, and I mean, I wasn't dyslexic when I was young. It wasn't until my son, my eldest lad, was in being assessed, then I realised that I was dyslexic. I just couldn't spell at the time. I remember teachers saying, you write good essays, but your spelling is hopeless, you know.
Wow.
Now, like, you know, with the problem with the Irish exemption thing, I mean, the way I see it is that if you really I come from a bilingual family. All my kids came up through Irish, and we've three out of five are dyslexic, but they went through education. The eldest guy is a master's, and he's an advanced paramedic. So it didn't hold them back. But if people really need,
and did the exemption, well, I know, and that's from one of the areas in Ireland about dyslexia, this exemption from Irish.
Yes, yes.
Did you apply? Did they get exemption?
No, they didn't. No, they never. They got help insofar as
okay.
That. I remember my middle daughter. She was in a room on her own, and she didn't particularly like it. Funny enough, and whereas she would have preferred, you think, to have taken the chance and just done the exam in the normal way. But the thing about it is, if people need the exemption, I've no problem with that. But don't tell me then that they're going over to do Spanish or French or some other language or German. You know, that doesn't make sense. Okay. And this is what's happening at the moment.
Do you think that is the case, that it's been used?
Well, I think it's been abused.
Okay.
I mean, I actually served on the board of the National Executive of Dyslexia Ireland.
Okay.
And, I mean, the thing about it was, like, we work very hard to get these exemptions and help people. And again, if they're being abused, well, then that's killing the whole point of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, say, like, go on.
Yeah, okay. And the department say, well, they have statements out saying the figures have gone up for people seeking and getting exemptions from Irish because of dyslexia, but they don't regard it as worrying. Katrina Fahey, Katrina, could I stay with us, Leo? Katrina,
yes,
Fahey, Katrina Fahey, you have dyslexia, and your daughter.
Yes.
And what do you think of what Leo said there, that some people are using dyslexia as an excuse to get out of Irish?
I suppose I would disagree with what he's saying. I think, I suppose dyslexia is a language difficulty. And I think my daughter availed of it as soon as she could. At seven, I would have seen dyslexia in her when she was three. Now, I am a paediatric occupational therapist, so I was very in tune with her difficulties, and very in tune because I knew also that there was a high possibility that she would also be dyslexic, because I am.
Okay.
So I suppose I did avail of it as soon as I could, and she wanted to because I could see her self-esteem, her confidence, her enjoyment of school was really decreasing, and her well-being. So, and like, she was only beginning her journey in education. I knew it was going to be long, and it needs to be. And I availed of it, and it was the best decision that I made. Saw it freed up her headspace. It allowed her to begin to learn and embrace and actually become secure in English.
And what do you think? I don't know if you heard the clip we played from Larry Mullen, and he was involved in making that that production in the States about dyslexia. What are you saying? Because I read other things he said in the interview. He said, we didn't fully understand it as parents.
Yeah.
Now, would you say that's true?
Yes,
and wider society, I suppose.
Yeah, I got diagnosed at 14. I would say I didn't. I went on to do nursing, and then I went on to become an occupational therapist. And I did not embrace it until I was doing occupational therapy. I didn't understand it. I didn't really know. I was just given a label, and that was it. And I think that's what's wrong. I think it's education. We have to be educating and empowering people. I see it. I actually have a master's in specific learning disability dyslexia, and I do assessments.
Okay.
And I see it in my clinic. People, you know, there's kids are struggling. You know, their self-esteem, their mental health is it's a big problem, and we're all identifying it as a problem.
Yeah.
But like, we need to start supporting these children and enabling them and to make decisions.
Sorry, Joe.
Leo, yes, Leo.
Sorry. I have no problem with children having exemptions from Irish. My children didn't need it. They went to workshops, and I went onto the board of the Dyslexia Association to say thank you for the amount of work they put in. But they put the work in themselves. But my argument is, I heard Joe Mullen or Larry Mullen talking about the rows he had at home.
Yeah.
We experienced that. And as the chairman of the Tala branch, I remember people coming to us, couples, and were in tears because they end up fighting. trying to help the child from different angles, like a male and a female approach to different things. But the work has not been put in at the school level. I mean, we at senior level, like colleges and universities, there's help provided. If they put the help in down the line at bunt school, you know, primary schools, they wouldn't need them at the other end, and that's where it's most help. I think if children need it, if a child needs a crutch, you get them a crutch. Now, the thing I object to is that someone get an exemption in Irish and then another language. As that lady said, it's a language difficulty. So, I mean, like, if the help is there, yes, use it, and then, but don't abuse it. That's the difference.
So, Katrina, does dyslexia make it difficult for me in every language? Learning every...
I suppose you can't say it's one way for everyone. Like, okay. I've kids that come into me at 15 who once I assess them, they come out as dyslexic, but actually love Irish and are very good at Irish. So it's not a one solution fits all. No, I actually 100% hope that my daughter can learn a second language, and I really want her to experience that. I suppose I know myself I would have done German in school. I would be better at it orally than writing it. Okay. And I could kind of understand bits today. But I don't, even if I go to France or go to another country, I don't have confidence exploring that language, because I feel I was having the confidence. I didn't have the confidence when I was younger. Okay. I didn't get that instilled in me.
Katrina, a caller to Joe Duffy's Liveline today. And you can listen to the rest of the discussion on the RTE Radio app. Manchester United is set to cut up to 200 more staff. It's part of a bid to counteract Old Trafford's £300 million loss over the past 3 years. And Miguel Delaney, chief football writer at the London Independent, joined Claire Byrne with the story.
For all the arguments about streamlining financially and, you know, the need of the club and the losses, figures like that are basically a kind of, they're such a small fraction of the actual expenditure a football club makes. I mean, people could easily point to the huge amount spent on player wages. I mean, look at someone like Anthony, who they've just sent on loan to Real Betis, a player who was on 25,000 a week at Ajax, and just 2 years ago, United signed him for over 80 million. And the reports are that his wage went up to 100, needlessly went up to 140,000, potentially 200,000. With bonuses, which is such incredible waste and leaves an even sour taste on redundancies like this that don't really compare to that, given they're generally kind of, I suppose, the jobs are kind of jobs are more regular wages. And I mean, there's not just that as well. There's also kind of the atmosphere it creates. A lot of people talk now about just how gloomy it is around United at the moment, how it come, and also, I suppose, how moves like this go against what the club is, the sort of... Ultimately, I mean, for all the business direction of modern football, these are still social institutions that are supposed to represent something more than just being a business. They play football to represent an area with all that entails. And I mean, stories like this, really, whatever they say about Manchester United, they also say a little bit about where modern football is going.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think you're right. It is so much part of the fabric of the community that if you start telling people who are, you know, lifelong Manchester supporters, never mind staff, probably intergenerational supporters, that they're losing their jobs, that is going to generate bad feeling in Manchester, right?
Yeah, and it has been pointed out as well, like, kind of this news came out on the day that they buried and that two staff members helped organise the funeral for Dennis Law, one of the great legends of the club, who evoked kind of this era and a greater romanticism. And I know the automatic response to this, and I hear this a lot in football, even from people within Manchester United, about how, you know, realistic decisions have to be made. This is just the modern world, and this is the economy we're in. But again, it's just about the scale here. And you compare these figures and say the amount that United spent, even actually the decision to not sack Ten Hag in the summer, when everyone expected him to go, when Manchester United were interviewing other candidates for his very job. So he was essentially being interviewed for his own job. They still stuck with him, despite trying to make a big change in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
But the extra cost in getting rid of him then 4 months later, well, that was money that could have been saved, that could have gone to jobs. I mean, this is the level we're looking at now. And again, yeah, it just says something about where the club is right now.
Yeah, because people, you know, just looking at this from the outside might have thought that when Jim Ratcliffe came in, that he was coming in with a bag of money, was a fan of the club, that this wasn't going to be the direction that he was going to take, which seems very hard line focus on the bottom line.
I suppose anyone that maybe looked at how Ratcliffe has operated in other companies, even other sporting companies, where the approach has been to trim down financially, I suppose that maybe a more kind of realistic expectation would have been that he does something exactly like this, even though I think the extent of it has surprised people. I suppose the good feeling when Ratcliffe came in was more so that the idea that the football operations of the club could finally change, I suppose, after a decade of inefficiency and waste and the club basically underperforming. And they might well do that. They're making a lot of changes there as well. There have been some very, very, very costly changes there, especially because it wasn't just Ten Hag they eventually got rid of. It was also Dan Ashworth, the sporting director, who they made. There was such a fuss about getting him out of Newcastle earlier in the year. He had to go on gardening leave. Then they bring him in and he doesn't even stay a year. He's gone so quickly. Now, again, maybe this will all be, or at least the football side, will be justified in the long run, but it doesn't take away the real effect on normal people's lives.
Yeah, it's just, I'm just looking at some of the cuts that he has made. So cutting the funding for the Manchester United Foundation, which works with local communities and underprivileged people. That was a million last year. Then there is the donation that they make to the former players' organisation. I mean, these are things that, in the context of what you've told us about what they're paying for managers and players, yeah, these seem really mean and nasty things to cut.
Well, basically, it's two player contracts really that cover this.
Yeah,
and this is where it's so. And I know I'm repeating the point here, but it's why it's so galling to me. This way, all the arguments about modern business practices and how you know have to face harsh realities—that's where they just fall down. Because then you're looking at the excess that is used on the squad, and this even as they're trying to cut down on the squad, but it still just feels so lopsided. And then when I was speaking to people at other clubs, they would say, and this is some very well-run clubs, among the best-run clubs in England, they would say, moves like this are baffling because even if there were an argument about financial savings in that regard, they almost cost you more in the long run because exactly what you're talking about, the kind of the bad feeling that's created, the effect on the community, and even, I know this is the cynical perspective on it, but it's still part of it, the public relations aspect, that you do lose out in many other ways and they can actually influence financial income eventually in some ways as well. Mm-hmm.
Well, it is still one of the biggest sporting brands in the world, Manchester United. Does it point to a wider issue with football across the board and the funding model?
I mean, football, like it's I've just written a book, I suppose, on this whole issue and football's entire economy and the kind of the influence of states and billionaires and private equity. Football's economy is very strange at the moment. But the thing about United is as well, And this points to how badly the club has been run for so long. Given that, despite the losses we're talking about, their revenues are still incredible. They're part of a group of 10 to 14 clubs, and United are generally always in the top five, six, with income or revenue that is far above anyone else. The clubs that usually always win. So it really shouldn't be possible for United to be as bad as they've been. In some ways, that's almost a feat of alchemy. Mm-hmm. But I suppose it does point to how kind of almost hysterical football's wage race has become, which is one of the major issues in the sport, especially when like there's a 90% correlation between what you spend on wages and what you spend and where you finish in the league. But United, I suppose, fall into the 10% because what they've spent on wages doesn't match league position.
Miguel Delaney, chief football writer at the London Independent, on Today with Claire Byrne. And that's Wednesday's Playback Daily. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and take care.